The Institute on Religious Life presents these lectures on Catholic doctrine by Father John A. Hardin of the Society of Jesus to give impetus to the new evangelization called for by Pope John Paul II. This series on Understanding the Bible, Part 5, was given during the fall semester 1993 at Domino's Farms, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
We have been, as you know, reflecting on various aspects of marriage. I thought in today's class and later classes, we would talk about marriage also, but emphasizing chastity and the Church's teaching, which, as you know, is so heavily under fire from the secularized world in which we are living. The present lecture, therefore, is on chastity and charity. We instinctively know that there's a connection between chastity and charity. We kind of assume, why not? We know from now, the whole of world history, that all failures in chastity are failures in charity. But as you know, it's also one thing to say something, even believe it. It is something else to understand what you may even know. We may know the what of something. We may not know the why or the how. We may not realize that chastity is charity of the body. And over the years of teaching theology, years ago I used to use bigger words and longer sentences. I found you get your point across better if you adjust your vocabulary to the audience you're speaking to, and then trim down both the length of the words and the length of the sentences. So much by way of introduction. These will be just, you might say, headlines of an oceanic subject, the relationship of chastity and charity. We begin by observing, however, on the general headline that we have a fallen human nature. We are all spontaneously, naturally selfish. I wasn't quite sure in my earlier days in the priesthood whether little children were selfish. I found they are. I may have told you about the mother trying to make a telephone call in O'Hare Airport, and I was carrying my bags, but I stopped just to behold the sight. She was holding the telephone, the receiver with one hand, holding on to the nearby wall with the other. Her 4-year-old boy did not want his mother to be, telephoning, but paying attention to him. He was pulling on her right leg. But she held firm. We are born selfish. And in fact, over the years, in trying to explain theology and not use polysyllabic words, I tell people one of the most clear evidences of our having a fallen nature is we are so spontaneously, congenitally, constantly selfish. But notice, we are naturally selfish. What we Catholics have got to keep constantly reminding ourselves of, that whatever we are naturally, and we don't deny that, our goal is to reach a supernatural destiny. And God, therefore, must provide us with, he will, supernatural means of reaching that. To repeat, supernatural destiny. Another word for that supernatural means is grace. Grace, as I'm sure you've heard so often, I know I've said it many times, grace is what enables us to do the humanly impossible. We naturally therefore want to satisfy ourselves, and given that natural instinct, it is built into our nature, given that spontaneous instinct to satisfy ourselves. Well, why are there other people in our lives? What a question. Of course, to satisfy us. It's natural. She's just being herself. That's the trouble. We then naturally want to satisfy ourselves. Now, the semicolon is the end of a generic principle. We all naturally want to satisfy ourselves. And then to finish the sentence, even or including at the expense of other people. I honestly believe most people who have never been called upon to define the words they use, I believe most people, if they came to define love and were honest in their definition, would say, well, I love someone, well, from whom I can get what I want, who gives me what I want. In other words, for us who have the faith, it is just the opposite. What others give us, even Christ himself in the Gospels, has one out of many examples of loving others. If you lend something, naturally, what should you expect? If you lend something, naturally, you should expect what? Not to have it returned. It's natural. And after a while, people even forget they borrowed something. You ask for it. You mean that's yours? We tend to hold on. We want ideas. Who does he think he is? I've got my ideas, and he's got his. And even though the mind might be rationally, watch this, even though the mind may be rationally convinced that something is not true, our minds naturally want to hold on to what is or are, either is our own idea or are our own ideas. That is why, as Dale Carnegie makes so plain, if you want to sell anything to anybody, if you want to make friends and influence people, don't begin by challenging the person that you want to, well, sell something to or befriend. Every human being is spontaneously jealous of his own ideas. They may be utterly and abysmally stupid, idiotic ideas, but because they are my ideas, I want to hold on. Again, because we naturally wish to satisfy ourselves, we tend to ignore other people. Oh, of course, we naturally want other people to pay attention to us. As a preoccupation with ourselves, and without a second thought, makes us ignore others. Because the first thought is always, of course, about ourselves. We naturally want what we want, and we do not, when we get it, want to share. Given what we've just said, our sexual desires are no exception. And I've got 5 illustrations of selfishness on the level on which we are here speaking. People will want sexual experience alone by themselves. And over the years of teaching moral theology, there's one thing I try to get across to my students. The essence of sexual pleasure is it is to be shared. Do you hear me? By the will of God. It is not to be indulged or aroused or experienced either by myself alone or, dare I use a preposition, with myself alone. Our natural tendency is to get sexual pleasure from another person without assuming responsibilities. In other words, as God has instituted the sacrament of matrimony, and just for the record, cultivate the habit of always distinguishing between marriage as a natural institution and matrimony as a supernatural sacramental institution. The church regularly uses matrimonium to identify marriage indeed, but supernatural marriage. again, spontaneously and naturally, the tendency is to get sexual pleasure from another without giving the other person our love. But remember, already the natural tendency to experience sexual pleasure without another person, and even more specifically, one's married spouse, being the one who shares in that, this manifestation of selfishness comes already in childhood. Oh, what a lot of re-education we believers in Christian morality need to understand that sexual pleasure is not meant to be experienced in isolation. Anticipating what we're going to say before this lecture is over, a person's mastery of his or her sexual passions is only as strong as that person's selfless charity. I didn't say this 30 years ago. I do now. And one of the blessings of the priesthood, many wonderful crosses and trials, but one of the blessings, you learn about human nature what you would otherwise never know, either by experience or by observation or by study. The thousands of people in the normal life of a priest who share their deepest experience in the center of their being is meant, under God, to enlighten the priest and educate him in a way that nothing else but the active priesthood can teach you. Selfishness and sexual passion go together. You will never control your sex passion unless, or shall I add, only insofar as you grow in selfless charity. You don't read that in Sigmund Freud. Our natural tendency is to get sexual pleasure from another person with no thought of God's purpose in sex, which is to bring children into the world and for married people both to bring children to the world and to express their selfless love for one another. I can say this. The hardest trial in so many marriages, and it can be on either side, either the wife or the husband, under God, being told they have a duty. The church calls it a debitum, a debt, to have marital relations with one's spouse. I repeat, one of the hardest trials for a spouse is to, satisfy that debt with a person who does not love you. Let me go on. the natural tendency is to get sexual pleasure from another person, even at great harm to the other person. Again, over the years, in dealing with so many people, the passion for sexual experience can be so strong that not only, say, the person not show love in marriage, genuine selfless love, and yet expect a marital embrace, but will even resort to the most extreme measures to satisfy one's pleasure, and that whether either with one's spouse or even with someone else. The passion of sex is the single most revealing manifestation of selfish desires. And that is why our nation, which has become, I think I can say this, an asylum of mentally disturbed people whose mental derangement is preoccupation with sex. And behind this, that's the purpose of bringing out that our fallen human nature being spontaneously and congenitally selfish, correspondingly, therefore, want sexual pleasure, and no matter what cost to another person, provided I am satisfied. I'm sure I've said this maybe more than once here in class, when my Jesuit friend told me, remember Father John Rook, one of the few survivors of the Dachau concentration camp, remember? There about 4.5 years, being a linguist, so the Nazis kept him alive. After months of the torture in Dachau, far in the night, we'd sit and talk, professional people. How can human beings be so inhumanly cruel? You never knew on your way to the mess hall where they'd be shot down because part of the, well, schedule. Someone would regularly be shot down on the way to the mails. Inoculation is some dreadful disease. And then die in spasms of pain. And for those of you who have not heard this, I've said this by now to 100 or more audiences. We found in every single one of those SS guards, as they call themselves, both men and women, every one was a sex pervert. And the two work together. And the measure that a person is selfish to that extent, that person's sex passions are not in control. And in the degree to which they are out of control, to that extent is that person, I'll use the word, bestially and even stronger, mnemonically selfish. We go on. Chastity builds on the love of God. If, as we've been saying, and it's a record of human history, the literature of all nations, be wiped out if he did not reveal the inevitable correlation between selfishness and sexual aberration. But notice, for us who believe, our love for others is only, as Christ reminds us, the second commandment. And it is second not only numerically, even just logically. It is second theologically. There can be no selfless love of other people. There cannot be without love for God. We are only as selfless in loving others. As a matter of fact, we can drop the adverb. We cannot love selflessly unless we love God. It's not even love. And the measure there, whether we love God, and only in that degree are we going to be truly selfless in loving others. And the reason, as you analyze it, is obvious. That's why God puts people into our lives. The main reason that God puts other people into our lives, call them by whatever name you wish, other characters, strange personalities, weird individuals. God puts them into our lives for this one purpose, that we might both manifest our love for Him, for God, and grow in our love for Him. And the more, to repeat the word, the more characters God puts into our lives, the more He wants us to show that we love Him. Again, I'm never sure, especially when I'm talking to an audience that, well, changes even from one Sunday to another. That the people that God puts into our lives, He places there, not only that we might be able to show how much we love God by loving them, but, and this comes from a doctor of the church, St. Teresa of Avila, the more God wants us to grow in our love for Him, the more difficult persons He will put into our lives. Oh, no, Father. Oh, yes. Or when you get home, you don't tell your wife, Mabel, I never knew how the Lord wants me to go in my love of Him. He put you, my dear, into my life. Not coincidentally, the Catechism of the Catholic Church brings this out with a clarity that I've never seen before in print. In other words, with our fallen human nature, our spontaneous tendency is to use people to our own advantage. And the closer we come in our union with God and love of Him, the more sure He is to place people into our lives who give us the blessed privilege of growing in our love for Him by loving even them. Now, I think we touched on this. We dealt with the Decalogue. The Ten Commandments, as you know, come in two parts. The first three commandments spell out the first commandment of the law. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart and soul and strength, and Christ added, remember, and your whole mind. So the first three commandments, are God's way of telling us on how we are to love Him. Change the focus. How we are to love Him. The last seven commandments are God's way of telling us how to fulfill the second principal commandment of the law. Thou shalt love thy neighbor. In the Old Testament, as thou lovest thyself. In the New Commandment, beyond that, even as I have loved you. The last seven commandments, therefore, are God's way of telling us how we are to love others. But note the arrow in that number two. We shall observe the Decalogue in its last seven commandments only in the measure and depth that we are observing the first three commandments. Only God knows how long our American school system will survive. Especially, of course, our public school system. For 5 years, I worked with some 60 other persons from different parts of the country, all public school administrators or educators, trying to convince our politicians that we must have, every school must have, from kindergarten on, must have some teaching of what we call the moral and spiritual values. Some religion must be taught. Without religion, there can be no morality. Am I clear?
Yes.
Religion is the first three commandments of the Decalogue. And the most sophisticated legal system, all the prisons in the world, all the draconian measures we can try to enforce to have people observe the commandments of the moral law, the last seven commandments, would be worse than wasted effort. Unless from infancy until mothers, and from the child's pregnancy, you mothers are teaching your children already when they're in your womb. Did you know that? I could spend hours explaining that. In other words, without that which is identified in the first three commandments of the Decalogue, the last seven, I don't see will not. They cannot be observed. because there's one thing that I must believe, however dimly, one thing that I must believe in every person who is in my life, that somehow I must believe that person is in my life and placed there by God. I don't see him, that is God, behind that person. I may tolerate the individual. I may endure the individual. I may even, if I'm in business, be patient with the individual. I never love. I will love no other person except myself. We don't need a decalogue to teach us to love ourselves. But to love anyone else except ourselves, we must love God. And the first three commandments tell us how that love of God is to be practiced. So number three follows logically. By the way, these charts, and I have hundreds of them, and some 40, 50, 100 pages on a single subject. They are for me the computer of the mind. The ideas are there, but they've got to be somehow pulled out. Number three. Unless I love God, I will not truly love others. I can say I love them, and when I marry, I can tell the person, I love you. And I may mean it. But just because I mean something doesn't mean that I possess the truth. And the truth is, there is no selfless love. And should I coin a word? No selfless love of anybody else except ourselves. We all love ourselves selflessly. Oh, what we won't do, what pain we won't undergo for ourselves. We won't love others unless we love God. But it's not just an absolute condition. It is also a measure, or to use the term, barometer, or for that matter, thermometer, because love is usually spoken of in terms of warmth. The barometer or thermometer of my love of anyone is how much do I love God? And again, as Teresa of Avila told her sisters, my daughters, you want to grow in the love of God. Wonderful. Dear sisters, do please grow in the love of God. But there's no other way. She's talking to cloistered nuns. There's no other way except by loving the sisters that God put into your life. Number four, the more I love God, the more I will love others. And though I spoke not for 1 hour, but for a month on this subject, and I could, the secret of growing our love for other people is growing in my love for God. And then the more I love Him, the more I will love others. The more I love others, I will grow in my love for Him. Number five. If I love God, I will give to others without selfish bargaining with my heart. Again, I didn't always talk this way. If I love God, really love Him, then I will give myself to others, and that without bargaining. My problem, after having taught theology for so many years, my problem is when I'm dealing with people to, well, put my theology aside and close the door, lock it, and even behind an iron safe, and make sure it's locked, to keep myself from reflecting on what is going on and dealing with other people. How spontaneously preoccupied we all are with ourselves. How naturally we expect people, well, to be nice to us. And may not even begin to ask ourselves, well, how am I acting towards that other person? What's that got to do? What has that got to do with my love for a person? Does a person have to be kind to me for me to be kind to him? Or patient with me to be patient with him? Needless to say, as I've told you more than once, during my graduate studies in psychology, that is not the mentality of the world in which we live. As I tried to reason at length with a professional psychologist this past week, a Catholic professedly, in a totally different world. I'm sure when he goes to Mass on Sundays, well, he will, I hope, he walks out of his psychological skeleton and thinks like a Catholic. We go on. Back to chastity. And here we are, selfless love in marriage. I have 6 items. I could have 60. The main reason for the breakdown of marriage, certainly in the Western world, is selfishness. And in fact, so many people in our country don't even bother making a lifetime commitment. And it's just as well. Millions are so preoccupied with themselves, the very thought of making a lifetime commitment to another person is literally unthinkable.